In the future, Douglas would always be drawn, as a believer and as a contrarian, to theological arguments and to the sheer power of biblical narratives and stories. But right now, with his Baltimore dreams lying dormant and cold, he needed personal faith. Such an awakening also came from his contacts with black preachers. Many fundamental ideas, and especially the sermonic cadences of the language in Douglass's narrative and in My Bondage and My Freedom, not to mention most of his early speeches, can be traced, in part, to the influences of a kind of black spiritual temperament and worldview that he soaked up from the African-American religious community of Baltimore in his teenage years. Along with the stages of enslavement he experienced on the Eastern Shore, and from the knowledge he constantly took from all around him, this was Douglass's closest thing to schooling. Frederick encountered a black lay preacher, Charles Johnson, who awakened the boy to prayer. Johnson spoke with him in tones of holy affection, Douglass wrote. Through the misery of doubts and fears, the desperate teenager underwent what he called a conversion to faith in Jesus Christ as the Redeemer, friend, and Savior of those who diligently seek him. With such language drawn from liturgy and confession, Frederick now cultivated his insatiable desire for knowledge by reading the Bible, Old and New Testaments. He might have even stumbled on the Sermon on the Mount. He now saw the world in a new light, he recalled. He felt new impulses for living, new hopes and desires. He even loved all mankind, slaveholders not excepted, though I abhorred slavery more than ever. My great desire now was to have the world converted. But his new faith was soon sorely tested. In this state of mind, religiously seeking knowledge, he met an old man, Charles Lawson, who quickly became his deepest influence. A drayman who worked for the owner of a rope walk on Fells Point, Lawson exuded a spirituality Frederick had never before encountered. Lawson lived only a short walk from Hugh Auld's house. The elder and the youth developed a cherished relationship. Douglass called Lawson alternately uncle and father. Above all, he was Frederick's teacher. To the young, despairing slave with a curious, if imprisoned, mind, Lawson was a holy man living in a hovel who prayed constantly while walking the streets or even in the midst of conversations. Frederick listened to Lawson and loved him. They became spiritual companions, spending all available hours singing, praying, and glorifying God. Lawson could read only a little, but he could interpret biblical metaphor, symbolism, and story as Frederick recited the words. For the young Douglass, slavery and life were his schools. But here, he received a tutorial like no other at the feet of the tattered, prayerful old man. I could teach him the letter, wrote Douglass, but he could teach me the spirit. Perhaps in their readings and recitations, he and Lawson stopped in Paul's letter to the Romans, as Douglass learned that for believers, the law, natural rights, was written in their hearts. Fred Bailey gained a lifelong fascination for Paul, the prisoner prophet. Lawson gave Douglass two priceless gifts. One was faith. The other was the insatiable desire for knowledge through a love of words. Lawson instilled in the youth a belief about which Douglass wrote intensely. God had a great work for me to do, he recalled as Lawson's charge, and the impressionable youth made a spiritual surrender to faith. His slavery was not permanent. Lawson helped him hope and believe. In thus nurturing Frederick's hope, Lawson prompted a craving for ideas, for books, for knowledge of the human morass in the Baltimore streets, as well as in the wide world beyond. From Lawson, Douglass took the challenge that I must go on reading and studying the scriptures. The praying drayman, like any of God's humble messengers in the Bible, had fanned my already intense love of knowledge into a flame. Lawson was a Jesus figure of a kind for Douglas, at a time when he desperately needed one. In 1855, he remembered Lawson as my dear old father, the very counterpart of Uncle Tom. The resemblance is so perfect that he might have been the original of Mrs. Stowe's Christian hero. We can only guess at what biblical passages Lawson and Frederick dwelled on in their many days together. But what Lawson seems to have stressed most were the freedom from fear and the power of humility. The frightened teenager said he came to feel under the guidance of a wisdom higher than my own. They may have read the startling visions in the book of Daniel. Mourning and trembling for many weeks, the prophet heard God speak to him. Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day thou didst set thine heart to understand and to humble thyself before thy God. Thy words were heard, and I am come for thy words. Whatever they read, Douglas found hope in the presence of this spiritual father, and was also beginning to find a calling. Among Douglas's most powerful cravings now was to learn what he called the art of writing. In his autobiographical memory, Douglas fashioned his emerging teenage literacy as his means of escape from slavery. It was his ultimate hunger, sometimes satisfied and sometimes not. In Baltimore, this early 19th century corner of a maritime world, full of immigrants, of the clash of languages and dialects, and of information that flowed in from the Atlantic Ocean and in front of his eyes via newspapers and books, Frederick observed the power of words. His job for a time at Durgan and Bailey Shipyard was to keep the fire burning under the steam box and to watch the yard when the carpenters broke for dinner. In these intervals, Douglas would sit on a crate and study pieces of wood the carpenters were hewing into ship's timbers. They were labeled S for starboard, L for larboard, SF for starboard forward, and so on. He memorized the letters and their uses. Moreover, Frederick loved it when the Aulds left him alone in the house. He had a grand time, he reported, appropriating Tommy's copybooks and reworking them. He crammed a flour barrel and a chair up into his kitchen loft, and there, with minimal light, the future author copied words, sentences, and whole passages from a Webster spelling book, the Columbian Orator, the Bible, and a Methodist hymn book. Out in the streets and at the docks, he created his own school tablets, even if he remembered it a bit romantically. With playmates for my teachers, fences and pavements for my copybooks, and chalk for my pen and ink, I learned the art of writing. This story alone should remind us why Douglas's autobiographies have sustained universal appeal. He knew that a slave stealing knowledge and the power of the word from the residue of urban maritime life, as well as from literary treasures no one could deny him, made a great story. By mining his memory for the details of his seizure of literacy, Douglas gave the world one of his greatest gifts. Words had become a reason to live. In March 1833, Frederick Bailey, a literate, intellectually curious, spiritually awakened slave, found his Baltimore dreams brutally disrupted yet again. An ugly slaveholder's feud between the brothers, Thomas and Hugh Auld, the one Frederick's owner and the other his current keeper, prompted his sudden forced departure back to the Eastern Shore. Thomas's wife, Lucretia, whom the child Douglas had adored, died in 1827, and he married Rowena Hamilton, the daughter of a wealthy Eastern Shore slaveholder, William Hamilton. Auld now lived in St. Michael's, the drab oyster fishing town along the Miles River, only a few bends before it opened out to the Chesapeake Bay. According to Douglas, the dispute between the Aulds stemmed from how to treat Douglas's young cousin, Henny Bailey, who was among the brood of slaves Thomas Auld had inherited from Aaron Anthony. As a child, Henny had fallen into a fire and burned her hands, leaving her with terrible disfigurement and incapable of most forms of labor. To Ault, recalled Douglas, Penny was of little more value than a horse with a broken leg. So Thomas sent the girl to his brother's household in Baltimore. But Hugh and Sophia found her of no value either. They soon sent her back to Thomas, who did not want her. This action led Thomas in a fit of pique to conclude, if he cannot keep Hen, he shall not have Fred. Douglas's portrayal of this episode may represent his desire to keep himself always at the center of his autobiographical tale. But such were the small destructive dramas in the daily life of American slavery. Were it not for the fame and literary mastery of Douglas, we would never know about the crippled Hennies of history. Feeling a shock to my nerves, the 15-year-old Frederick found himself on a cold day aboard the sloop Amanda, again on his way back to what would now seem the desolate, imprisoning landscape of his youth. As he took his place in Auld's overcrowded house and general store at Cherry and Talbot Streets, actually in a separate kitchen dwelling out back, in St. Michael's, he was one of four town slaves, including his older sister, Eliza, his Aunt Priscilla, and Henny. He wondered whether he would ever see Baltimore or feel its urban hopes and energies again. The 17-year-old Eliza became Frederick's staunch ally. She was already considered married to a free black man named Peter Mitchell, to whom Auld would eventually sell her. She conspired with her angry younger brother in their day-to-day resistance to Auld's rule. Exceedingly depressed, Frederick not only missed his friends, the docks, his religious mentor, Lawson, his access to books and newspapers in Baltimore. He also now felt physical hunger. A growing teenager with likely an insatiable appetite, he scrounged for and stole extra food by almost any means necessary. Auld was stingy, wrote Douglas of this dark time in his slave life, but his new wife, Rowena, was outright cruel. Indian cornmeal was virtually the only food allowed the blacks at Auld's kitchen. Douglas's memory of this experience inspired in him one of his most elaborate philosophical defenses of natural rights doctrine as applied to slaves under the yoke of bondage. He had a perfect right to steal his master's food or any other possession, Douglas later argued, because not only had Auld rendered him property, but the slave society had marked him privileged plunder. Douglas believed he was, therefore, by birthright, justified in plundering in turn. The hungry antebellum slave in an immoral system, the bored laborer with nearly crushed hopes of liberty, later spoke with a raw logic more powerful than the slaveholding revolutionaries of the late 18th century. The morality of a free society can have no application to slave society. Slaveholders have made it almost impossible for the slave to commit any crime, known either to the laws of God or to the laws of man. If he steals, he takes his own. If he kills his master, he imitates only the heroes of the revolution. In this brutal environment, Douglas became a student of human nature, of the slaveholder's mind, and of the fullest meanings of human rights. He was also becoming, by experience, a dangerous slave rebel. Frederick Bailey came to believe the plunderer shall in due time be plundered. But he was still hungry. The gnawing stomach, boredom, rage, and a growing intelligence mixed to make Frederick a troublesome slave. He and Auld made a perfectly disastrous pair, symbolic of why slavery was not only evil, but sometimes economically a dead end for both master and slave. By Douglas's account, Thomas Auld merited no respect as a person, much less as a slave owner. As an adult abolitionist, 8 to 10 years after his tormented years as a teenage slave, Douglas became the movement's most astute source on slaveholder mentality and character. Auld, he maintained, was not a born slaveholder. He was a poor man, pilot of a bay boat, and an inheritor of slaves by marriage. His main character trait was meanness. He lacked strength and consistency in his handling of slaves, and though he craved power, He seemed only weak and miserable in exercising it. Douglas lived to condemn Auld with words meant as daggers to the heart of all lordly masters. He was cruel, but cowardly. He commanded without firmness. Auld tried to rule with the fury of a demon, but he might well be mistaken for an inquirer who had lost his way. He was, Douglas snidely said, not even a good imitator. In August 1833, Frederick attained a special insight into Auld's character when his master allowed him to attend a religious revival at Bayside, some 8 miles from St. Michael's. This classic country Methodist camp meeting left indelible images in Douglas's fertile memory. People came from all over Talbot County. 2 steamboat loads of pilgrims also arrived from Baltimore. The gathering lasted a week, and slaves relieved of work for a few days could hardly resist the excitement of hundreds of campfires roasting meat, a veritable tent city with a preacher stand in the middle, and a pen marked off for mourners to enter and make their confessions, embrace the Lord, and be saved. A recent convert himself to Christian faith, although now struggling to understand whether God intended any justice on earth, Frederick witnessed the spectacle of Master Thomas's wrenching, emotional breakdown and confession in that pen. Blacks were not allowed in the pen, nor in front of the preacher's performances. But Douglas tells us that he imposed his way close enough to hear Auld groan, and to see his reddened face, his disheveled hair, and a stray tear halting on his cheek. Here festered the dark heart of the moral bankruptcy of slaveholders that the future abolitionist would make his central subject. Douglas converted this memory into angry condemnations of the religious hypocrisy of the entire Christian slaveholding universe, especially the little microcosm of Auld's household. For the young slave now had to listen daily to loud praying and testifying by the white family, and to participate in hospitality extended to local preachers, who were sometimes housed at Auld's home, all the while enduring the good Methodist's verbal and physical cruelty. For Douglas, the proof of any sincerity in Auld's teardrop manifested in his actions. In his deeds and his glances, wrote Douglas, it was as if the pathetic master had concluded, "I will teach you, young man, that though I have parted with my sins, I have not parted with my sense. I shall hold my slaves and go to heaven, too." Such a vow, imagined by Douglas from the memory of his owner's cowardly eyes, might serve as an unspoken motto of the Christian capitalists who ruled the antebellum South. Amid this despairing situation, Frederick found what he called something worth living for. A pious young St. Michael's white man named Wilson discovered that Fred Bailey was literate, with a Baltimore background, and asked him to help with a Sabbath school to be convened at the house of a free black man named James Mitchell. With 12 old spelling books and a few Bibles, they began meeting with 20 pupils on Sundays. Frederick loved this chance to use his mind again. "I could not go to Baltimore," he reminisced, "but I could make a little Baltimore here." Before the second meeting finished, however, a mob led by Thomas Auld and 2 other white slave owners Douglas named stormed into Mitchell's house with sticks and epithets, driving the little band of eager learners back to their drab hovels. One of the pious crew in the mob accused Frederick of becoming another Nat Turner, he recalled with ironic relish. By the 1840s, Douglas would become one of the abolition's fiercest critics of pro-slavery religious and secular hypocrisy. But he did not need to learn that argument from William Lloyd Garrison, nor any of the other Garrisonians who made anti-clericalism a major tenet of their crusade. Here, in this isolated backwater of American slavery, Douglas had seen and felt on his body and in his soul the blood-chilling blasphemy at the heart of pro-slavery piety. The professedly holy men who owned his body and tried to own his mind had taught him virtually all he needed to know on that count. Douglas seems to have adopted a devil-may-care attitude of desperation toward Auld. Auld responded, by beating Frederick for the first time. Although, as he recalled these whippings, the proud former slave portrayed his master's handling of the whip as that of a hapless amateur. Not so, however, when Auld tied up Cousin Henny to a joist and took out his frustrations on the crippled girl. Auld would beat her mercilessly with a cowskin before breakfast, then leave her hanging by her strapped wrists for 3 to 4 hours, only to return later and beat her again. In Frederick's mind, Auld's piety dripped with Henny's blood. In this miserable circumstance, Frederick became essentially an unmanageable teenage slave. He verbally confronted Auld, refused to work, and repeatedly let the master's horse run away. Auld resolved to send Douglas out to be broken by a local slave overseer who rented his time and humble farm for just such a service. Auld's pious cruelty now transformed into an even darker hell. On January 1st, 1834, Douglas began a year of living in a kind of wilderness of horror at Edward Covey's dilapidated farmstead. With his few belongings wrapped in a bundle on a stick braced over his shoulder, Frederick walked 7 cold miles westward from St. Michael's to a country setting overlooking the Chesapeake Bay. In the art of his autobiography, this place would be the tyrant's home, the dark night of a strong young teenager broken and rendered a brute by a totalitarian regime ruled by one savage man. Ishmael found his Ahab, the ultimate tyrant whose obsessions could never be tamed, and by whom the world could be wrecked and taken down. Douglas found his Covey, who would bludgeon and wreck the young slave, but against whom the sufferer would resurrect himself through violence and will and find another reason to live. Douglas's pivotal year as a 16-year-old under Covey's savagery is forever cloaked in some of his most beguiling and lyrical prose. The chapters on the time under Covey's brutal rule are the longest in Douglas's first 2 autobiographies. The experience is crafted so artfully that it is often discussed as little more than a literary creation, a brilliant text that lives beyond or above the barnyard, the fence posts, the oxen team, the silent corn and wheat fields, or the dense woods of that eastern shore landscape. But Covey was real, and Douglas left a good deal of blood in the soil of that arch-villain's farm, while also extracting a story he would one day make almost as immortal as Herman Melville's whaling ship. Douglas's great gift, and the reason we know of him today, is that he found ways to convert the scars Covey left on his body into words that might change the world. His travail under Covey's yoke became Douglas's crucifixion and resurrection. Although Douglas portrayed Covey as a professional slave breaker by trade, in 1834 he was actually a relatively poor 28-year-old farmer with a wife and infant child who hired slaves to work his rented farmstead. Covey paid Auld for 1 year's service of the strong young slave. Perhaps most disgusting to the young Christian Fred Bailey were Covey's and his wife's religious devotions, acted out in their house every morning and night. At night, Covey would have his small family, which included a cousin employed as a worker, as well as the 3 slaves, gather for hymns. Since Covey was a bad singer and Frederick had a fine voice, the master would order the slave to lead the hymn. Douglas found such flaunting of religious hypocrisy nauseating. Sometimes, he reports, he would lamely sing. Other times he would simply refuse and dare his brother in the church to beat him. The daily problem was that Frederick was for the first time forced to be a field hand, working from first light to sunset, performing tasks for which he had no experience. By any measure, Covey was a sadistic taskmaster, and for all those who simply refused to believe that the lash was a vivid part of the everyday lives of American slaves, Douglas demonstrated otherwise. On his 3rd day at Covey's farm, the brute viciously beat him with a switch making the blood flow, and leaving painful wales on his back that would fester and hurt under his coarse wool shirt. Those physical scars on his back would remain an occasional piece of Douglas's abolitionist repertoire the rest of his life. Rarely would he whip off his shirt and show them, but they were always there as a physical and rhetorical device to shock the complacent audience. Within the first month, Covey purposely sent Frederick out with a wagon and a largely unbroken team of oxen to retrieve wood. With no training in how to handle the massive animals and the reins, he lost control, crashing the wagon twice, once in the dense woods, and once into a gatepost. Douglas later gave an account of this episode with elaborate detail and converted it into a rich anti-slavery metaphor, as he also converted Covey himself into the worst creature slavery could produce. "There I was, all alone," Douglas wrote, "in a thick wood, to which I was a stranger, my cart upset and shattered, my oxen entangled, wild, and enraged, and I, poor soul, I knew no more of oxen than the ox driver is supposed to know of wisdom." With an axe, at least he had chopped wood before, Frederick managed to disentangle the oxen and get his cart back to the farmyard to face the consequences of his disaster. In the memory of this episode, as with so many others, he taught his readers the meaning of slavery. I now saw, in my situation, several points of similarity with that of the oxen. They were property, so was I. They were to be broken, so was I. Covey was to break me, I was to break them. Break and be broken. Such is life. He had become the beast, as Douglas remembered his mental and physical faculties during this period of despair. He anticipated future totalitarian systems and leaders as he remembered Covey's methods of terror and control. Sometimes the wordless farmer, with the fierceness of a wolf, would grunt and lunge at Frederick with sticks or cowskins and slash his head and back over and over, leaving the laborer bleeding and all but resigned to these expected assaults. But Covey also possessed a cunning like no other slaveholder Douglas ever encountered. He and his two fellow unlucky slave workers on this isolated farm called Covey the Snake. The scoundrel would crawl in ditches and gullies, or hide behind stumps and bushes to spy on his slaves and startle them into hard work. Covey, said Douglas, could make him feel as though he was always present. To a lonely, despondent, brutalized, but literate 16-year-old slave who had seen the city and read of an even wider, wondrous world, Covey embodied the system that now imprisoned Fred Bailey in a desolate corner of the Eastern Shore, a wilderness of unseen, untold violence from which he might never have returned. By midsummer, in this daily hell, Covey achieved what Douglas claimed was the overseer's motive. I was broken in body, soul, and spirit. My natural elasticity was crushed. My intellect languished. The disposition to read departed. Behold, a man transformed into a brute. Sundays provided Frederick his only downtime. Lonely, with no one to confide in, he tells us he would lie down under a shade tree and spend many hours in a sort of beast-like stupor between sleep and wake. Sometimes he would stroll over toward the Chesapeake Bay, which was only a short distance from Covey's depressing farmstead, and the people, black and white, with whom the tall, brainy boy found no conversation. There he would allow himself an occasional burst of imagination, a daydream he would 10 years later capture in a beautiful and haunting metaphor of freedom. Sitting in a small room at a spare desk in Lynn, Massachusetts, in the winter of 1844-45, Douglas peered back into his memory and wrote a passage for the ages. Our house stood within a few rods of the Chesapeake Bay, he remembered, whose broad bosom was ever white with sails from every quarter of the habitable globe. Douglas then captured slavery and freedom with artistry unparalleled in the genre of slave narratives. Those beautiful vessels, robed in purest white, so delightful to the eye of freemen, were to me so many shrouded ghosts to terrify and torment me with thoughts of my wretched condition. I have often, in the deep stillness of a summer's Sabbath, stood all alone upon the lofty banks of that noble bay, and traced, with saddened heart and tearful eye, the countless number of sails moving off to the mighty ocean. The sight of these always affected me powerfully. My thoughts would compel utterance, and there, with no audience but the Almighty, I would pour out my soul's complaint in my rude way, with an apostrophe to the moving multitude of ships. Then, perhaps gazing through the wintry window in Lynn, Douglas shifts and speaks directly to the ships, trying to re-enter a teenager's imagination. You are loosed from your moorings and are free. I am fast in my chains and am a slave. You move merrily before the gentle gale, and I sadly before the bloody whip. You are freedom's swift-winged angels that fly around the world. I'm confined in bands of iron. Oh, that I were free. Oh, that I were on one of your gallant decks and under your protecting wing. Alas, betwixt me and you, the turbid waters roll. In such a prose poem, Douglas wrote a psalm-like prayer of deliverance in his narrative, rendering in the music of words the meaning of slavery's potential to destroy the human spirit, but at the same time transcending his remembered misery to declare at the end of the lament, in language reminiscent of the slave spirituals, that there is a better day coming. Before ending this meditation, as though bracing his face and body to a sudden wind off the bay, he declared that he would one day take to the water and bravely steer a northeast course. He would indeed one day toss his tears upon that sea and dream his way back to and out of Baltimore. And in the decade before the Civil War, as today, his readers could and can still stand with Douglas in the dark night of his soul along their own Chesapeakes and sense the deepest of human yearnings in their own souls. One day, in the terrible heat of August, Frederick broke down physically while threshing wheat in the hot sun with other slaves. He fell into a delirious stupor, experiencing what modern medicine would call heat exhaustion or stroke. With terrible head pain, his limbs trembling, and likely a dangerous fever from lack of water, the clammy-skinned youngster crawled to a post and rail fence for shade. The wheat fanning stopped, and Covey came out to the scene, demanding that Frederick stand up. Douglas remembers that he could not speak, and that Covey kicked him savagely in the ribs. Then he beat the youngster about the head with a hickory stick, leaving a bleeding gash. As Covey joined the work crew, replacing Frederick, the stumbling slave regained his feet and fled into the woods. There, in fear and exhaustion, he resolved to walk through the nighttime forest back to St. Michael's to plead his case before his owner, Thomas Auld. Barefoot through bogs and briars, staying off the roads so as to avoid Covey if he pursued him, Frederick made it to Auld's store that night. With blood clotted on his head and his torn shirt blood-stained, the ragged supplicant begged for Auld's protection. Auld paced the floor, refused to believe most of Frederick's horror story, and ridiculed him as the perpetrator of his own travail. The master ordered his slave to go back to serve out the remaining months of his term, lest Auld lose the whole year's wages. With this lesson in slaveholders' avarice, Douglas stayed the night, and without food the next morning, made the 7-mile trek back to Covey's dreaded lair. Broken in spirit, what did Douglas ponder as he stumbled back to a fate of more abuse? Did he think of Father Lawson and wonder if any God existed? did he feel a loneliness in his bones far greater than the pains in his injured body? Did he imagine, with near homicidal scorn, a picture of Ault and Covey in their Methodist pews, praying for good crops, healthy families, and the warrant of their own salvation? Was his mind simply lost in contemplations of the sheer scale and weight of injustice? Did he try to pray, with only tearful false starts and wasted sentence fragments for his efforts? All this and more, he implied, his bludgeoned mind thought, and his body felt as he walked. For now, he could not even see the sailing ships if they leaped off the ocean waves. As soon as Covey saw Frederick step over a fence rail, the tyrant pursued him with a whip and a rope. The young man fled again into a field of tall corn, where he hid. The ferocious hound, as Douglas called Covey, could not find him, likely expecting that his slave would ultimately return again out of hunger. Frederick found temporary safety in the woods, where the weary fugitive lay down on a bed of leaves, shut in with nature and nature's God. Confused and frightened during the night, he encountered a fellow slave, Sandy Jenkins, who was walking several miles to visit his wife, a free black woman. Jenkins, too, had been hired out for the year, and he took pity on the desperate younger man and, at considerable risk, ushered him to his humble home. Sandy's wife helped Frederick to wash his scarred and bloody body and fed him a freshly baked ash cake. Douglas remembered this human touch, relieving a brother bondman, as a saving grace in the midst of his torment. In 1855, he called this moment at Sandy's cabin, "The meal of all my life, most sweet to my taste, and now most vivid in my memory." Before departing the next morning, Sandy, who fashioned himself a spiritual advisor and, to anguished Frederick, seemed a genuine African, gave the runaway a special root to wear only on his right side for protection as he returned to Covey's domain. Unmoved by the logic of Sandy's magical powers, Douglas nevertheless decided he had nothing to lose and wore the talisman as instructed. More in line with his own self-understanding and portrayal, though, Douglas attributed much of Jenkins's kindness toward him to the neighborhood knowledge of his literacy. Claiming he was the only slave in the region who could read and write, Douglas preferred to wear his learning rather than a conjurer's herbs from the forest floor. "Although I was hated by Covey and by my master," Douglas maintained, "I was loved by the colored people, because they thought I was hated for my knowledge and persecuted because I was feared." Always ready to offer himself as a symbol of the power of the word and of the will, he nevertheless admitted that in this desperate summer night, his good Samaritan had a strong case. "My book learning," he remembered Sandy telling him, "had not kept Covey off me." A powerful argument just then. It was a Sunday morning as Frederick once again came into Covey's yard, and the pious slave driver said good morning on his way to church services. Covey did not beat slaves on the Sabbath. Monday morning was another matter. What ensued was the most celebrated fight between a master and a slave in all of anti-slavery literature. For the elaborate details of this rumble in a stable and a farmyard, which Douglas claimed lasted for 2 hours, the autobiographer is our only source. He wrote of it with an odd formality, as though he were the observer cleaning up a deadly blood sport for sentimental readers. Whatever the duration and nature of this violent melee, for Douglas, it grew into the pivotal turning point in his life as a slave. Slaves who resisted and fought their masters sometimes did not live to tell about it, or at least found themselves in transit to a worse fate farther south. Covey caught Douglas by surprise, coming down from a hayloft, and tried to tie his legs. In language that became melodramatic and moralistic, even if blow by blow and full of bravado, Douglas nevertheless admitted that he did not at first know from whence came the daring spirit and his fighting madness. Douglas claimed to have fought strictly on the defensive, which does not ring true. Covey became flustered, even frightened, with much puffing and blowing. He called on two other slaves to help him grab and hold Frederick, but the rebel kicked one of them into agonized submission, and the other simply refused and comically said he just wished to work. The two grunting fighters grappled and threw each other on the ground. Douglas says he strangled Covey by the throat, drawing blood with his nails, and his tormentor simply gave up. As one scholar has suggested, Douglas wrote of this fight as though it were a performance, a staged and ritualized battle in this master-slave drama. Another historian has called the fight a stylized death dance. It also later served the former slave's story as the establishment of his manhood by ritualized violence. "I was nothing before," he wrote. "I was a man now." As he told of it over and over in public forums later, he portrayed his victory over Covey as the demonstration of the physical force necessary for male dignity and power. He had bested the tyrant. He now possessed an inner freedom and an outward pride. It was a resurrection from the dark and pestiferous tomb of slavery, Douglas said, to the heaven of comparative freedom. He convinced himself, not without reason, that Covey exacted no public or legal retribution. Frederick could have been arrested, tried, and hanged for such resistance, because of a coward's shame and fear for his reputation. The wounded boy was now a man who could lift his head high and tell the world that old Covey never again laid a hand on him in his remaining months in that country prison. Most of all, embedded in all the talk of manhood, he admitted that his spirit, all but lost in the woods those despairing nights, could now revive. "The defeat of Covey," he said, "rekindled my Baltimore dreams."
Chapter 5. Now for Mischief. No man can tell the intense agony which is felt by the slave when wavering on the point of making his escape. All that he has is at stake. The life which he has may be lost, and the liberty which he seeks may not be gained. Frederick Douglass, 1845. Douglas likely never forgot the sensation of his hands gripping Covey's throat, his fingernails drawing blood, as he strangled the slave master. Whether it happened or not, as Douglas later described it, the feeling became real in memory. By January 1st, 1835, after spending the annual holiday week watching and imbibing with the rest of the slaves in the St. Michael's region, as they frolicked, danced, and drank their days away with their master's approvals, Frederick Bailey was ready for more rational sensations. He was once again hired out by Auld for a year to another local farmer, William Freeland, whose land fronted on the Miles River. As Douglas endlessly explained the nature of slavery to public audiences later in the 1840s, a major theme of his writing and speeches was the slaveholder's mentality. Their quest not only for control of the bondman's body, but more important, to destroy his thinking powers. By temperament and apparently strategy, Freeland, who did not even attend church and practiced leniency about food, labor routines, and general emotional autonomy among his slaves, allowed Frederick more space and time to think, read, and as it turned out, to clandestinely teach. Freeland did not beat his slaves. Though his soil was worn out from too much tobacco husbandry, his tools were much better than most, and he was a fair broker with his slaves' need for rest. Frederick liked Freeland, especially in contrast to his previous year of suffering under Covey. Douglas's mind, he recollected, gained increased sensibility. In Bondage and Freedom, he drew beautifully upon 1 Corinthians, to say that the natural and temporal in human needs come first, and afterward that which is spiritual. He later mused in memoirs and speeches about how his time with Freeland taught him that when a slave gets a good master, it makes him only wish to become his own master. Frederick had gained a reputation in the region because of the fight with Covey, and his literacy made him a special 17-year-old among a mostly older group of male slaves who became his beloved band of brothers on Freeland's place. Douglas loved, a word he sparingly used in remembering his slavery years, especially four young men, brothers Henry Harris and John Harris, Andy Caldwell and Sandy Jenkins, the root man, now working on the same farmstead with Frederick. As Douglas set up this scene of mental liberation amid a group of trusted comrades, he delivered a clever jolt of foreshadowing. "Now for mischief," he declared. I had not been long at Freeland's before I was up to my old tricks. Quickly, that winter and into summer, Frederick gathered eventually more than 30 male slaves on Sundays, and sometimes even on weeknights, in a Sabbath literacy school. He may have constructed the Covey fight as his resurrection from a living death into manhood, but Douglas's real manhood, his real vocation, emerged here in his leadership among a cherished group of eager learners and fellow dreamers. Here on the farm of a just slaveholder, in downtime from working as a field hand, the future Frederick Douglass found his first abolitionist flock. Here, in the woods, behind the barn, and in the shade of trees, Frederick discovered his charisma and burnished his love of words. "The fact is, here I began my public speaking," he later wrote. With the Columbian Orator in his hands, which he had somehow kept hidden from the Coveys and Aulds in his life, and with a Webster spelling book and a copy of the Bible, Frederick, now tall and with an adult's deeper voice, stood before these young men and preached the power of literacy as the means to freedom. Under an old live oak on the eastern shore on summer Sabbaths, practicing gestures with his arms and shoulders, and modulating the sounds and cadences of his words, as the Columbian orator instructed, the greatest anti-slavery orator of the 19th century first found his voice. One wonders if before any of his thousands of speeches and appearances later in life, as he listened to someone drone on introducing him, or as he stepped to a lectern, a fleeting memory of his oak tree congregations danced in his mind. Douglas loved his days and nights teaching his fellow slaves. "I have had various employments during my short life," he wrote in 1855, "but I look back to none with more satisfaction than to that afforded by my Sunday school." Douglas's autobiographical writing is often extremely self-centered, drawing hard boundaries around his sole character, himself as the melodramatic self-made hero. But his remembrance of the Sabbath school is one time when he expressed an abiding love, an attachment deep and lasting for his supporting cast. Frederick was the leader now of a local brotherhood, unlike anything he had known before, a gang of word lovers and emerging readers. They were brave and fine-looking as a group. He had never known other such friends in his life to the age of 37. As he rhapsodized in 1855. No band of brothers could have been more loving. They had secret passwords for group protection in their risky business, and what they especially possessed was a sense of a male-bonded home in their wilderness of work and hopelessness. For Frederick's bursting spirit, these were great days to my soul. In the midst of these clandestine adventures in literacy and comradeship, Frederick and his four closest friends launched an escape plot. At the beginning of 1836, Freeland rented Frederick for yet one more year of labor. Douglas later portrayed himself as glad to stay on Freeland's place. He could continue his teaching and building of his band of readers as he turned 18 years old. But he also, perhaps quite honestly, remembered himself as not only ashamed to be contented, but ashamed to seem contented. Frederick felt a new level of despondency, the kind born of the same increased liberty to think, speak, and create the intense desire to be free in his devoted compatriots as he had felt at a younger age in Baltimore. He left many haunting expressions of this longing in the mind of a slave reaching adulthood with an imprisoned mind. The grim visage of slavery, he wrote on behalf of all slaves, can assume no smiles which can fascinate the partially enlightened slave into a forgetfulness of his bondage. In a combination of providential, psychological, and even military language, Douglass told of his escape plot that nearly ended his abolitionist career before it started. "The prophecies of my childhood were still unfulfilled," he claimed in retrospect. As he remembered Father Lawson's words, predicting God's purposes in Douglass's rise in the world, Frederick believed that at 18 he had grown too big for my chains. His group of five conspirators plotted their backwater rebellion like a tiny military company, with Frederick as their captain, always watching his own deportment, lest the enemy should get the better of me. Just before the Easter holiday, in the spring of 1836, they planned to steal away into Chesapeake Bay in a large canoe owned by William Hambleton, whose large estate bordered Freeland's farm. Douglass mistakenly calls him Hamilton in the autobiographies. Rowing their way north some 70 miles to the head of the bay, and then trekking by foot overland to the free state of Pennsylvania. Wildly ambitious, and based on inadequate geographic knowledge, the plot had little hope of success, although they could visualize themselves out on the bay, claiming either to be fishermen working for their masters, or slaves allowed the holiday week off from labor. Frederick employed his literacy now to a political end for the first time. He wrote a pass for each member of the band, authorizing him to spend the Easter holiday in Baltimore, and signed W.H. These desperate young men decided to steel their nerves in group solidarity, in songs, in their secret meetings and handshakes, and in their faith in their youthful leader, who stood erect over their battlements and strove for the right words of resolve. Their bravado, however, had to coexist with fear. Frederick and his team met by night around their quarters and on Sundays out in arbors. The 18-year-old played the commanding officer of the platoon preparing for war. He argued for the plan against all its admittedly logical obstacles, what he called phantoms of trouble. He cajoled, instilled spirit when they needed it, drew mental pictures of hope when they all felt desperation, and tried to instill all with firmness. But Frederick's pep talks did not suffice. In his autobiography, Douglass later presented this episode brilliantly as a journey into the psychology of the runaway slave. Fred Bailey may have enjoyed his role as the band's leader by words and personality, but he shared their sense of psychological terror about betrayal and capture. As they rehearsed for their fateful day of flight out of Egypt, Douglass remembered they could preen and swagger for one another one moment, and the next, the Harris brothers might just stare in silent dread into Frederick's eyes, awaiting his next direction. "We were confident, bold, and determined at times," wrote Douglass, "and again, doubting, timid, and wavering, whistling like the boy in the graveyard to keep away the spirits." When they sang to steady their nerves, a favorite hymn rang out. "O Canaan, sweet Canaan, I am bound for the land of Canaan. I thought I heard them say there were lions in the way. I don't expect to stay much longer here. Run to Jesus, shun the danger. I don't expect to stay much longer here." Douglass hastened to point out that for his band of runaways, it was not heaven they sought just then. The North was our Canaan. But what about those lions? They could not sing them away. 9 years later, Douglass left a probing statement of the recurring dream/nightmare of the runaway slave, as though he wanted to tear apart the romance of the Underground Railroad and replace it with a vision of the fugitive slave's real psychic hell. "At every gate through which we were to pass," he wrote on behalf of his comrades and every other bold runaway, "we saw a watchman. At every ferry, a guard, on every bridge, a sentinel, and in every wood, a patrol." The options faced by the runaway came from deep in historical time, from the ancient circumstance of the oppressed choosing life or death against the overwhelming weapons of the powerful. On the one hand, there stood slavery, a stern reality, glaring frightfully upon us, wrote Douglas as dramatist of the macabre. Its robes already crimsoned with the blood of millions, and even now feasting itself greedily upon our own flesh. On the other hand, away back in the dim distance, under the flickering light of the North Star, behind some craggy hill or snow-covered mountain, stood a doubtful freedom, half frozen, beckoning us to come and share its hospitality. Why tempt such a monster infesting their thoughts? On every side they saw grim death in horrid shapes. They saw themselves drowned in the ocean, their bodies torn by bloodhounds. After thus characterizing the mind of the fugitive slave, Douglas went to Shakespeare's Hamlet and allowed his comrades the moment to rather bear those ills we had than to fly to others that we knew not of. But they could still somehow see that distant hill. Then Douglas invoked Patrick Henry's famous "Give me liberty or give me death" speech from the American Revolution, and claimed that the American slave rebels' right to this bold resolution was more sublime than any by one of the founding fathers. The lash and chain had bought that privilege. So, brave but terrified, Frederick and his small band awoke on their prospective day of deliverance, Saturday, April 2nd, 1836. They had packed little bags and gone to the field to do their early morning work, spreading manure. Their plot fell into disaster almost immediately. They had been betrayed, Douglas later thought probably by Sandy Jenkins, who had withdrawn from the plot in tortured anxiety. As they gathered at the kitchen near Freeland's house, Frederick spied four white men on horseback and two blacks walking with them, coming down the long lane into the property. Then came the aging and rotund William Hambleton, riding at a gallop. After a brief consultation between Freeland and Hambleton, within seconds the constable seized Frederick and tied his arms with rope. Then they moved to the Harrises. John was subdued and tied, but Henry physically resisted, refusing to allow his hands to be tied by these men who were armed. One constable drew his pistol, cocked it, and aimed it point blank at Henry's breast. "Shoot me! Shoot me!" shouted Henry in defiance. "You can't kill me but once. Shoot! Shoot! And be damned! I won't be tied." Then the whole group assaulted Henry, drove him to the ground, and subdued him in ropes. While all were distracted, Frederick threw his pass into the kitchen fire. Later, he instructed the others to eat theirs. In Freeland's front yard, the four bound young men were fastened with ropes to three horses, guarded by the mounted constables, and prodded off on a 15-mile forced march to the county jail in Easton. Before departure, Mrs. Betsy Freeland, the landowner's mother and Hambleton's sister, who had long-standing affection for the Harris brothers, railed at Frederick as the corrupter of the innocent. "You devil," she screamed at him. "It was you who put into the heads of Henry and John to run away. But for you, you long-legged yellow devil, Henry and John would never have thought of running away." Douglas, the bound prisoner, met her gaze, he says, with a look that matched her wrath. After 3 miles, the coffle stopped in St. Michael's at Thomas Auld's store, where Frederick's owner interrogated and berated him. But Douglas tells us that he defied and responded to Auld in kind with a lawyer-like argument that no crime had been committed, no evidence existed, and logically, no one had any case against him, except for the words of a betrayer. Then the journey resumed on the dusty road to Easton. All along the roadway, through little hamlets called Spencer's Cove, Royal Oak, Kirkham, and Miles Ferry, crowds of what Douglas called moral vultures gathered to jeer, shout epithets, and indulge in ribaldry at the expense of the slave prisoners. Some yelled that Frederick should be hanged or burned. Such an event in rural slave country made for a spectacular break in routines and a feast for lurid rumors.